must get Izana dressed, brushed, powdered, and perfumed to sit with her. One of the soldiers of the 4th Regiment who were encamped upon the common was earning a little money helping at the light stable. As Scylla moved away from Johnny, the groom leaped forward to open the kitchen door for her. Why, that mannered monkey? Bowing and flunkying about because of just Scylla Lapham? That red-headed parrot couldn't even talk English right. But he had known what Johnny had not. Scylla was a grown-up young lady, and she was pretty. "Scylla?" Johnny yelled at her. "Come back a moment, please." She left the groom bowing and smirking. "Yes," she said, standing before Johnny under the apple trees. "Look here, what's that fella's name?" "Pumpkin?" "That's not a name." "Yes, it is. It's his. Nobody ever..." "No girl could be a Mrs. Pumpkin." "Nobody. Ever." There was so long a pause, Johnny's next words sounded awkward. "You were right about one thing. Priscilla Tremaine, that's a fine name." He had meant to make a joke, but as the words left his mouth, it was not. They both stood, embarrassed, looking at their feet. Scylla did not answer, but she reached up through the foliage of the tree and picked a little green apple. She gave it to him. "I didn't know even winter apples were still so green," she said, and walked off toward the house without a glance for the admiring pumpkin. Johnny put the apple in his pocket. He'd keep it forever. It meant that Scylla really thought Tremaine was a fine name. "No. You can't keep even little green apples forever. It would wizen up, or grow ripe, or it might rot. Human relations never seem to stand completely still. This apple, for instance. It might ripen into something better than it now was, or, unromantically, it might rot away in his pocket." He put it on the windowsill and a little superstitiously waited to see what it would do. But Rab ate the apple. Johnny, already jealous for the first time in his life, over Rab's taking Scylla out, buying her sweets, and never saying anything, tried his best to quarrel with a puzzled Rab over this apple. It ended as Johnny might have guessed it would. Rab refused to be impressed with his crime. All he had done was to eat a wormy, no-good apple. "He'd give Johnny a peck of better ones, just so you'll stop glaring at me." "Was it really wormy, Rab?" "It was." He had been a fool to think of the apple as a symbol of himself and Scylla. 5. It was fall, and for the last time Sam Adams bade Johnny summon the observers for 8 o'clock that night. "After this, we will not meet again, for I believe Gage knows all about us. He might be moved to arrest Mr. Lorne. He might send soldiers to arrest us all." "I hardly think they would hang the whole club, sir, only you and Mr. Hancock." Johnny had meant this for a compliment, but Sam Adams looked more startled than pleased. "It has been noticed that every so often many of us are seen going up and down Salt Lane, entering the print shop. We must, in the future, meet in small groups. But once more, and for the last time, and make as good a punch for us as you can." As Johnny went from house to house talking about unpaid bills of 8 shillings, he was thinking of the punch. Not one ship had come into Boston for 5 months except British ships. Only the British officers had limes, lemons, and oranges these days, they and their friends among the Boston Tories. Miss Light had God's plenty of friends among the British officers. He'd get his tropical fruit there. Mrs. Bessie listened to him. "And who's going to eat these fruits or drink them if I do give you some?" "Well, Sam Adams, for one." "Don't say any more. Give me your dispatch bag, Johnny." She returned with it bulging. "No limes, though. Izzy eats them all." "Does she do tricks for them, like she used to for the sailors along Hancock's Wharf?"
"Tricks? Does she do tricks? Lieutenant Stranger has taught her a rigmarole about poor Nell Gwynn selling fruit at a theater. I don't need to tell you how she carries on."
"What happened to that cousin Sewell?"
"Gone to Worcester. Joined up with the Minutemen. But he's too fat and..." Soft? No. From now on, nobody's too fat, nor soft, nor old, nor young. The time's coming.
It would be a small meeting, for of the 22 original members, many had already left town to get away from the threat of arrest by the British. Josiah Quincy was in England. Of the three revolutionary doctors, only Church and Warren remained. Dr. Young had gone to a safer spot. James Otis was at the moment in Boston. Johnny had not notified him, although he had founded this club in the first place. Ever since he had grown so queer, the other members did not wish him about, even in his lucid periods. He talked and talked. Nobody could get a word in edgewise when James Otis talked. This, the last meeting, started with the punch bowl on the table instead of ending with it. There was no chairman, nor was there any time when the two boys were supposed to withdraw. They were talking about how Gage had at last dared send out a sortie beyond the gate of Boston, and, before the Minutemen got word of their plans, they had seized cannon and gunpowder over in Charleston, got into their boats, and back to Boston. Not one shot had been fired, and it was all too late when the alarm had been spread and thousands of armed farmers had arrived. By then the British were safe, home again. Yet, Sam Adams protested, this rising up of an army of 1,000 from the very soil of New England had badly frightened General Gage. Once the alarm spread that the British had left Boston, the system of calling up the Minutemen had worked well indeed. The trouble had been in Boston itself. In other words, gentlemen, it was our fault. If we could have known but an hour, 2 hours in advance what the British were intending, our men would have been there before the British troops arrived instead of half hour after they left. Johnny had been told to carry letters for the British officers, to keep on good terms with their grooms and stable boys over at the Afric Queen. Somehow he had failed. He hadn't known. Nobody had known that 260 redcoats were getting into boats, slipping off up the Mystic, seizing Yankee gunpowder, and rowing it back to Castle Island for themselves. Paul Revere was saying, "We must organize a better system of watching their movements, but in such a way that they will not realize that they are being watched." Sam and John Adams were standing, and the other members were crowding about them, shaking hands with them, wishing them success at the Continental Congress in Philadelphia. They were starting the next day. Everyone was ready to give them advice, whom to see, what to say, or to prophesy the outcome of this Congress. Paul Revere and Joseph Warren were apart a little, making plans for that spy system which was needed badly. They called Johnny to them, but he could hear one of the men standing about the two Adamses saying, "But there must be some hope we can still patch up our differences with England. Sir, you will work for peace." Sam Adams said nothing for a moment. He trusted these men about him as he trusted no one else in the world. "No, that time is past. I will work for war. The complete freedom of these colonies from any European power. We can have that freedom only by fighting for it. God grant we fight soon. For 10 years we've tried this and we've tried that. We've tried to placate them and they to placate us. Gentlemen, you know it has not worked. I will not work for peace. Peace, peace, there is no peace. But I will, in Philadelphia, play a cautious part, not throw all my cards on the table, oh no. But nevertheless, I will work for but one thing, war. Bloody and terrible death and destruction. But out of it shall come such a country as was never seen on this earth before. We will fight." There was a heavy footstep across the floor of the shop below. Rab leaped to the ladder's head. "James Otis," he reported to the men standing about Adams. "Well," said Adams a little crossly, "no one need stay and listen to him. He shot his bolt years ago, still talking about the natural rights of man and the glories of the British Empire. You and I, John, had as well go home and get a good night's sleep before leaving at dawn tomorrow." Otis pulled his bulk up the ladder. If no one was glad to see him, at least no one was so discourteous as to leave. Mr. Otis was immediately shown every honor, given a comfortable armchair and a tankard of punch. Seemingly he was not in a talkative mood tonight. The broad, ruddy, good-natured face turned left and right, nodding casually to his friends, taking it for granted that he was still a great man among them, instead of a milestone they all believed they had passed years before. He sniffed out his punch and sipped a little.
Sammy, he said to Sam Adams, my coming interrupted something you were saying. We will fight. You had got that far.
Why, yes, that's no secret.
For what will we fight?
To free Boston from these infernal redcoats and...
No, said Otis.
Boy, give me more punch.
That's not enough reason for going into a war. Did any occupied city ever have better treatment than we've had from the British? Has one rebellious newspaper been stopped? One treasonable speech? Where are the firing squads? The jails jammed with political prisoners? What about the gallows for you, Sam Adams, and you, John Hancock? It has never been set up. I hate those infernal British troops spread all over my town as much as you do. Can't move these days without stepping on a soldier. But we are not going off into a civil war merely to get them out of Boston. Why are we going to fight? Why? Why? There was an embarrassed silence. Sam Adams was the acknowledged ringleader. It was for him to speak now.
We will fight for the rights of Americans. England cannot take away our money by taxes.
No,
no.
For something more important than the pocketbooks of our American citizens.
Rab said,
for the rights of Englishmen everywhere.
Why stop with Englishmen?
Otis was warming up. He had a wide mouth, crooked and generous. He settled back in his chair, and then he began to talk. It was such talk as Johnny had never heard before. The words surged up through the big body, flowed out of the broad mouth. He never raised his voice, and he went on and on. Sometimes Johnny felt so intoxicated by the mere sound of the words that he hardly followed the sense. That soft, low voice flowed over him, submerged him.
For men and women and children all over the world, he said. You were right, you tall, dark boy. For even as we shoot down the British soldiers, we are fighting for rights such as they will be enjoying 100 years from now. There shall be no more tyranny. A handful of men cannot seize power over thousands. A man shall choose who it is shall rule over him. The peasants of France, the serfs of Russia, hardly more than animals now. But because we fight, they shall see freedom like a new sun rising in the west. Those natural rights God has given to every man, no matter how humble.
He smiled suddenly and said,
or crazy, and took a good pull at his tankard. The battle we win over the worst in England shall benefit the best in England. How well are they over there represented when it comes to taxes? Not very well. It will be better for them when we have won this war. Will French peasants go on forever pulling off their caps and saying, "Oui, monsieur," when the gold coaches run down their children? They will not. Italy and all those German states, are they nothing but soldiers? Will no one show them the rights of good citizens? So, we hold up our torch and do not forget it was lighted upon the fires of England, and we will set it as a new sun to lighten a world.
Sam Adams, anxious to get that night's good sleep before starting the next day for Philadelphia, was smiling slightly, nodding his gray head, seeming to agree. He was bored. It does not matter, he was thinking, what James Otis says these days, sane or crazy. Joseph Warren's fair, responsive face was aflame. The torch Otis had been talking about seemed reflected in his eyes.
We are lucky men, he murmured, for we have a cause worth dying for. This honor is not given to every generation.
Boy, said Otis to Johnny, fill my tankard. It was not until he had drained it and wiped his mouth on the back of his hand that he spoke again. All sat silently waiting for him. He had, and not for the first time, cast a spell upon them. They say, he began again,
My wits left me after I got hit on the head by that customs official.
That's what you think, eh, Mr. Sam Adams?
Oh, no, no, indeed, Mr. Otis.
Some of us will give our wits, he said. Some of us all our property.
Hey, John Hancock, did you hear that? Property, that hurts, eh?
To give one's silver wine coolers, one's coach and four, and the gold buttons off one's sprigged satin waistcoat.
Hancock looked him straight in the face, and Johnny had never before liked him so well.
I am ready, he said. I can get along without all that.
You, Paul Revere, you'll give up that silver craft you love? God made you to make silver, not war.
Revere smiled.
There's a time for the casting of silver and a time for the casting of cannon. If that's not in the Bible, it should be.
Dr. Warren, you've a young family you know quite well. If you get killed, they may literally starve.
Warren said, I've thought of all that long ago.
And you, John Adams, you've built up a very nice little law practice, stealing away my clients, I notice.
Ah, well, so it goes.
Each shall give according to his own abilities, and some, he turned directly to Rab, some will give their lives. All the years of their maturity, all the children they never lived to have, the serenity of old age. To die so young is more than merely dying, it is to lose so large a part of life.
Rab was looking straight at Otis. His arms were folded across his chest, his head flung back a little. His lips parted as though he would speak, but he did not.
Even you, my old friend, my old enemy. How shall I call you, Sam Adams? Even you will give the best you have, a genius for politics.
Ah, go to Philadelphia. Pull all the wool, pull all the strings and all the wires. Yes, go, go. And God go with you. We need you, Sam. We must fight this war. You'll play your part, but what it is really about, you'll never know.
James Otis was on his feet, his head close against the rafters that cut down into the attic, making it the shape of a tent. Otis put out his arms.
It is all so much simpler than you think, he said.
He lifted his hands and pushed against the rafters.
We give all we have. Lives, property, safety, skills, we fight, we die for a simple thing. Only that a man can stand up.
With a curt nod, he was gone. Johnny was standing close to Rab. It had frightened him when Mr. Otis had said, some will give their lives, and he looked straight at Rab.
Die so that a man can stand up.
Once more, Sam Adams had the center of attention. He was again buttoning up his coat, preparing to leave, but he first turned to Revere.
Now he is gone, we can talk a moment about that spy system you think you can organize in Boston.
Paul Revere, like his friend Joseph Warren, was still slightly under the spell of James Otis.
I had not thought about it that way before, he said, not answering Sam Adams' words. You know, my father had to fly France because of the tyranny over there. He was only a child. But now, in a way, I'm fighting for that child. That no frightened lost child is ever sent out a refugee from his own country because of race or religion.
Then he pulled himself together and answered Sam Adams' remarks about the spy system. That night, when the boys were both in bed, Johnny heard Rab, usually a heavy sleeper, turning and turning. Johnny, he said at last,
are you awake?
Yes.
What was it he said?
That a man can stand up.
Rab sighed and stopped turning. In a few moments he was asleep. As often had happened before, it was the younger boy who lay wide-eyed in the darkness.
that a man can stand up. He'd never forget Otis with his hands pushed up against the cramping rafters over his head. That a man can stand up. As simple as that. And the strange new sun rising in the west. A sun that was to illumine a world to come. Chapter 9. The Scarlet Deluge. That fall, Paul Revere did organize a spy system. 30 artisans, mostly masters, from all over Boston were the center. Each of these men had workmen and apprentices under him. And these had friends, and the friends had friends. So this web of eyes and ears multiplied and multiplied again, until a British soldier could hardly say he'd like to swim in Yankee blood, or a couple of befuddled young officers draw out a campaign on a tablecloth at the Afra Queen, but it was reported. It was noted exactly which regiments were on duty in different parts of Boston, and how strong were the earthworks Gage was putting up to protect his men if the country should rush in. All such news, important and trivial, was carried to the 30, meeting secretly at the Green Dragon. It had caused comment that so many leading Whigs had been seen ever and anon converging upon the Observer's office. It aroused no comment that 30 men of humbler rank, master workmen like Paul Revere the silversmith, Thomas Crafts the painter, or Chase the distiller, met at the Green Dragon. This old stone inn was owned by the Masons. Most of them were Masons. So why should they not meet in the proverbial secrecy of their society? Every time they met, each man swore upon the Bible that these meetings be kept secret, that anything they discovered of British plans should be told only to the 4 men who were looked upon as the leaders of the Boston Whigs. These were Sam Adams, John Hancock, Dr. Warren, and Dr. Church. Already many others had thought it was safer to leave Boston. Anything Johnny picked up, he usually reported to Paul Revere, but sometimes to Dr. Warren. He had been assigned his own particular duty. This was to keep sharp track of Colonel Smith and the other officers of the 10th Regiment who were living at the Afra Queen. As long as Goblin was stabled there, no one was suspicious if Johnny hung about the stables, the yard, and the kitchen. He was on good terms with the British grooms and, by great good luck, from the point of view of a spy system, intimate with the Colonel's horseboy, Dove. "Don't you lose track of that Dove, Johnny," Paul Revere commanded him, "for if ever the British march out to attack us, a colonel's horseboy might well know something is happening in advance." Every day Johnny knew what orders were given to the 10th, and he knew other boys and men and women and girls were as carefully watching the actions of the other 10 regiments in Boston. Lydia, the handsome black laundress at the Queen, extended his own eyes and ears into the very bedrooms of officers, and often, as he helped her hang up her sheets, she would tell him this and that, but nothing of any value, until one day she called him out of the stable where he was grooming Goblin. "Johnny boy," she called, "you help me hang up these here sheets and I'll give you a sweet." "What's up?" he whispered as soon as he had helped carry out the heavy basket of wash. "Last night, just before bedtime, Colonel Smith, he sent for me 'cause he says I sent up a shirt as wasn't his. And dat dare Lieutenant Stranger, he was standing by the fireplace thanking his colonel for permission to go on de little business. He was looking real happy like young folks do as have been allowed to attend a party." "But a little business might be anything." "Yes, but Stranger, he likes fighting real good. He ain't no cardboard soldier like some of these British boys. And he whistled happy as a robin as he went into his own room. And he sat up for an hour or more writing letters and tearing them up and writing again. And this morning he sent off one to Miss Lavinia Light by Dove. But these scraps of paper I got in my pocket are his trials and errors. I can't read. And he did tear them up. But here they are." "Lydia, give me your pocket." She unpinned the little calico bag from her waistband. Johnny stuffed it inside his jacket and ran back to the printing office. It took no time to put together 2 letters which Stranger had written and discarded. First he had written Miss Lavinia. Johnny knew he was dancing attendance on her, a rude note bluntly declining her invitation to a frolic, which on the 15th of December would follow a military concert. Today was the 12th. "Evidently," said Rab, "he explained too little in his first letter and too much in his next, so he tore them both up and tried a third time." Rab, Mr. Lorne, and Johnny all had their heads over the drawing board where the second letter was pieced together and spread out. The first part was missing, and he had never finished it. As Lovelace said so long ago, I could not love thee, dear. So much loved I not honour more. 'Tis honour only, my dear, my very dear Miss Light, which forces me to decline your most gracious invitation for the 15th of December. The honour of a soldier and eyes, even brighter than your brilliant orbs, the bright eyes of danger, call me forth. To you alone I will confide that on that night I shall be 60 miles north of here, for we must have all of our forts sufficiently strengthened, so as—" Then he had stopped.
60 miles, said Mr. Lorne.
That's Portsmouth, Fort William and Mary. They have only a handful of men on duty there and a vast store of powder and ball.
No wonder, Rab was saying. Stranger tore that letter up. It certainly let the cat out of the bag.
Where are you off to, Johnny?
I'm off to Paul Revere, Johnny yelled over his shoulder. He had not stopped for overcoat or mittens. From the lowering December sky, handfuls of snowflakes were falling, but as soon as they came to earth, they turned to ice. It was a bleak, bad, dangerous day for the long ride north. 10 minutes after Johnny told him the news, Revere was in the saddle buttoning his fur-lined surtout to his ears. His wife had so recently borne him another child, she was still abed. She rapped on a window pane, and Johnny ran to her.
"He forgot this," she said,
and handed him the hasty scrawl she had had the wit to write. In it, Paul Revere was begged by a make-believe relative in Ipswich to come in all haste. His grandmother was on her deathbed. Johnny had to laugh. The British soldiers at the neck were asking more and more questions of any known Whig, and sometimes, for a whim, would refuse to let him pass and often again delay the trip. Mrs. Revere's letter would allay their suspicions. That night, over icy roads and through howling winds, Paul Revere rode the 60 miles. Even before the British got into their transports, word had come back to Boston that the King's fort at Portsmouth had been seized and His Majesty's military stores stolen by the rebellious Americans. Scylla reported to Johnny that Lieutenant Stranger did, indeed, attend Miss Lavinia's handsome frolic, and a more gloomy young man she had never seen.
2.
Even in the old days of the Lapham shop, Dove would have been Johnny's friend if Johnny would have had it. The enmity between them was the younger and smarter boy's fault. As soon as Johnny began to cultivate Dove, he was surprised at the response. Dove had always been lonely, and he still was. The Yankee boys threw bad words and oyster shells at him because he worked for the British. The British horse boys badgered him. Lieutenant Stranger thought he was the stupidest, laziest pig he had ever met, and told him so at least once a day. Colonel Smith was not above knocking him down if his horses were ill cared for. But Johnny's feelings toward Dove had changed. Dove was garrulous, indolent, complaining, and boastful, but it hurt Johnny when the other boys bullied him and his masters beat him. He was like a man who owns a dull, mean dog. He may punish it himself, but resents it if anyone else punishes it. For better or worse, Dove was now his own private property. Once a day, twice a day, and sometimes 3 times in 1 day, Dove would sneak over to the observer's office. Here for a few minutes he could get away from the swearing and cuffing of his superiors and the malice of the grooms. By Rab and Johnny's standards, they were often rude to him. By his own, they treated him fine. At least he was allowed to slump into a chair, complain, boast, and eat. It was hard to watch Dove swilling their meager food, but the way to his heart seemed to be through his stomach. What they had, they shared with him. Although badly treated by the British and kindly by the 2 Yankee boys, Dove had become violently pro-British, at least when talking to Rab and Johnny. He considered himself part of the British army and was always bragging about what we were going to do to the rebels.
"Yep, we're gonna march right out of here," he was saying one day, "and we'll kill every rebel we meet, skin 'em, cut off their heads. And here in Boston, just as soon as old Gage gives the signal, we're gonna string up every rebel. Hundreds of 'em, yep."
Johnny yawned. He could not help it.
"Oh, they know all about you. You haven't been given any riding to do for them of late, have you?"
True enough, although Johnny had not found out one thing of genuine value by the letter-carrying he had done for British officers, it had been a good contact and he needed the money. He had been sorry to find that he was no longer employed. It was I that warned him. I told him and told him that that Johnny Tremaine was a rebel of the deepest double dye.
So Dove had gone out of his way, had he, to be mean?
Oh, you blat, 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 talk, talk, talk. I know what's my duty to report and what's my duty to keep Mum about. Take military secrets. I don't tell him.
As soon as he had arrived, he had walked over to the cupboard where the boys kept their food and helped himself. As he talked, the crumbs came dribbling out of the corner of his loose mouth.
For instance, he went on, you didn't know, did you, that last December Lieutenant Stranger almost went on an expedition to Portsmouth? I knew he was planning to go, but I knew enough not to say anything to you about it. I can keep a secret, all right.
Thanks to Lydia, they had known about this. But they had no idea that Dove, too, had known at the time.
That's no secret now.
But it is a secret where old Gage will strike next.
You'd like to know, wouldn't you?
I could tell you if I had the mind to.
Why don't you give me something to drink?
Rab and Johnny exchanged a glance. Johnny poured him a tankard of ale. Maybe he knew more than they thought. But would the mild ale loosen his tongue?
You wait a moment, Dove. I'll be right back.
Johnny ran through the backyard to the Afric Queen. He knew Colonel Smith had told Lydia that one of his young gentlemen was prone to solitary tippling. If she ever found a bottle of brandy in his chamber, she was to take it. He did not say where she was to take it to. Lydia took away the young gentleman's bottle in the morning when she made his bed, but was not above reselling it to him in the evening. Johnny came back, a brandy bottle in his hand.
Now this, he promised, we'll pick up that flat ale something fine.
He poured in so generous an amount that Dove's white lashes quivered with anticipation.
You certainly are a good guy. My, that's great. That's the stuff. Well, as I was saying, here it is March. That's spring. Armies don't stay cooped up in springtime. They march out and fight.
He hiccuped for the first time.
Fight battles. And the battle we are going to fight... Fight this springtime? Me and the rest of the boys? Well, I warn you. If I was you, I'd not wait. I'd start running and not stop until I came to the Berkshires.
I don't believe they'll move the army all the way out to the Berkshires.
Who said anything about the army going to the Berkshires? There are no military stores there. And King's commanded old Grandma Gage to confiscate all rebel stores. His Majesty's real mad. Got his royal dander up. He thinks Gage is scared because he don't take action against the rebellion.
Gage already has tried 3 times to seize our supplies. Charleston, Salem, and Portsmouth.
Once he did, and twice we were too quick for him. He doesn't know where our things are hidden.
Don't he?
Don't he?
Johnny filled his tankard again with the horrifying concoction. Dove belched with satisfaction.
They've got maps. Maps and map cases. They've got Worcester and Concord marked in red. They know where to go, all right. Don't you wish you knew just how many active troops there are in Boston now?
How many?
Dove's figure was wildly inaccurate. It looked as though they had wasted their ale and Lydia's brandy. Dove was getting maudlin. There were tears in his eyes as he told them how much he loved them.
Best friends ever had, he mumbled. Best boys in the world.
And he suddenly struck out at the British.
They're mean guys, he cried angrily. I'm going to the Berkshires with you two. I'm not going to stay here in Boston nursemaiding them there horses. Dig a hole. Get in hole. Pull hole in after me. Keep safe till war's over. Boys, boys,
he cried in alcoholic despair. You come with me. I can't stand for you to hang. I can't.
And he burst into tears. Pull yourself together, Rab ordered sternly. He was less easygoing about some things than Johnny.
Sure, I'll pull right out of here.
He got unsteadily to his feet.
I'm going to tell that stranger I quit. I'm going to throw a curry comb in Colonel Swish's fist. I'm going to...
Oh, hold on there. No, you're not, Dove, said Rab, blocking the door. You're going to sit down, see, and cool off. It would never do to let Dove return to the inn in such a state. He'd get fired. The boys had overcooked their own goose. It took them half an hour to quiet Dove. Over and over they explained to him what a fine job he had and what a glory it was to be part of the British Army. Finally, Dove began to subside. He was getting sleepy.
Well, it don't make any difference. I'll get fired anyhow. Stranger told me to get the colonel's horses all shined up good. Told me get Nan around saddled by 4-something, maybe 4:30.
He leaned back and slept.
Looks like I'll have to do his work for him, muttered Johnny. We can't let him get fired. It's 4 now. Oh, that swill pig, that louse!
He ran for the stable. Before this, he had often helped Dove with his work. The colonel had 2 horses, the heavy yellow charger called Sandy he had brought with him from England, and the light pacing mare Lieutenant Stranger had picked out for him after he had decided Goblin wouldn't suit. Nan, this second horse, had easier gaits than the old war horse. The colonel much preferred her for hacking about Boston, but she was not yet well trained for drums and volleys. The colonel, a poor horseman, never risked his dignity on her when he went out with his troops. Then he rode Sandy. Nan was beautiful and affectionate. Sandy, sweet-tempered, old, and wise. Johnny liked them both. As Dove slept, Johnny worked and whistled. At 4:30 he had Nan saddled and led her to the mounting block in front of the inn. The fat colonel could not mount or dismount from the ground.
"Take her back, boy," Lieutenant Stranger told him. "Colonel Smith is bilious."
Then he noticed it was Johnny, not Dove, and his handsome face brightened. He asked no questions.
"Look, you," he said. "Run fetch your horse and I'll take Nan. I want to show you how to jump."
Stranger had already told him of the hurdles at the foot of the common. Johnny had wistfully watched red-coated officers schooling their horses over them. He had not dared try them himself. He was afraid they would order him away. But no one would order away any friend Stranger cared to bring with him. Although the very young officer was proud and class-conscious enough when they met indoors at the Lights or the Afra Queen, once both were in their saddles they were equals. He was an ardent teacher who had at last met a pupil worth bothering with. Or rather, 2 pupils. For at the end of the first lesson he said Goblin was the finest natural jumper he had ever seen. Johnny knew he longed to own him himself. He could, any moment, by merely saying, "Commandeer." And Johnny knew he would never say it. From that day, he and Johnny spent hours together jumping or exercising horses. Johnny almost worshipped him for his skill and almost loved him because, ever and anon, he looked so much like Rab. But still, it was only where horses were concerned they were equals. Indoors, he was rigidly a British officer and a gentleman, and Johnny an inferior. This shifting about puzzled Johnny. It did not seem to puzzle the British officer at all. 3. Now Johnny did not ride all over the countryside on Fridays and Saturdays to get back late and tired, taking the last ferry from Charleston home to Boston Saturday night. First, there was no ferry, and second, the guards at the town gate were too curious. They would demand to see what was in his dispatch bag, and after looking at the papers, dump them in the mud. They would pretend it was an accident, but it was not. Uncle Lorne arranged with one of the Silsbees of Lexington to smuggle out the papers in his farm wagon when he came in every week to market. One day, late in March, Johnny started out to deliver his papers, for it was Thursday. But Goblin was so unmanageable, he decided to take him over to the common first and let him get the kinks out of him. As usual, he walked the horse through the British encampment, through the idle men, stacked muskets, military stores, camp kitchens. The sentry led him by, but the next moment an officer, half-shaved and in shirt-sleeves, was shouting at him, something about, "Getting that fool out of here!" and, "What's that boy doing here? Hey, stop him! Grab his bridle!" So Johnny knew that the troops were getting edgy. Never before had they bothered him as he merely walked his horse through the encampment down to the open fields close to the Charles. There was nothing for him to do but sit tight and take what was coming. The men rushed at Goblin and grabbed him so roughly the horse was frightened. One man was knocked down and another kicked before Johnny could quiet him. The dispatch bag of newspapers fell to the ground at the feet of the burly, half-shaved, shirt-sleeved officer.
Let's see what sort of sedition this rogue is bringing in among His Majesty's loyal troops.
His face behind lather darkened as he glanced at the paper in his hands.
Sedition. Incitement to rebellion. Why, if it isn't that damned Boston Observer, if I were Gage, I'd hang the printer of it and this young imp as well. Boy, you're going to get a horse-whipping. Perhaps you still are allowed to peddle such lies about the streets of Boston, but not among the ranks of His Majesty's First Brigade. Sergeant Clemens, 30 lashes on his bare back.
Yes, sir.
Then Johnny noticed that the private holding Goblin's head had orange hair, a freckled-faced little fellow no bigger than himself. It was Pumpkin who earned extra money working at the light stable. Their eyes met. Pumpkin didn't say the word, only formed it with his lips. Spurs. Johnny struck his spurs into Goblin. The already excited horse leaped into the air, whirled about, lashing out with his heels, then bolted. Johnny saw redcoats going down in heaps, but one more persistent than the others, a sergeant, still hung to his bridle. By sheer weight, he was wearing the horse down. Johnny, like every boy in Boston, had a clasp knife in his pocket. He got it out, reached forward, and cut the headstall. So he lost both the sergeant and the bridle as well. Goblin flung up his beautiful head and went off on a dead run. Johnny never understood how the horse could run so fast without tripping over tent pegs, campfires, stacks of muskets, sheep bought for slaughtering. He heard a pistol shot. That would be an officer. They alone carried pistols. Probably he had fired into the air. They were always doing that. Soon he was off the common shooting up the Hancock Drive. Without a bridle, he had no control whatever over the runaway. Goblin chose to double and weave through fields and orchards with Johnny flat on his neck to keep from being scraped off by low branches, behind the Hancock and lighthouses, over a stone wall, down a back alley, over a fence like a tomcat, frightening an old lady who was hanging up clothes so she almost swallowed a clothespin, down into West Boston, and again up Beacon Hill. The horse was winded and quieter now. Mrs. Bessie and Scylla were always giving him carrots. It was no wonder that he now turned in at the lights and was ready to listen to Johnny's voice. Easy, easy. So, look, Goblin, I'm here. Nothing's gonna hurt you. So quietly, quietly, softly now. Easy, easy. The bridleless horse came to a stop at the back door of the lights. Soaked with sweat and heaving, he looked about him, hoping for a carrot. One of the light's black coach horses was tied in the stable yard. A man was grooming him. It was Pumpkin, his military tunic off hanging on the fence. Pumpkin looked up, grinning. I'd rather take those 30 lashes than ride a horse like that without no bridle. Oh, I like riding, Johnny said airily. He had really been a bit scared, but he wasn't going to admit it. Tell your master, said Pumpkin. Those papers went well to do a deal of good. The British regulars? Yep. Lots of them are Whigs, you know. Lots of them, just like in England, are on your side. He knocked his currycomb against the trunk of a tree. That's why there's been so much deserting. It's just about getting our officers crazy. But deserters get shot, down by the hurdles at the foot of the common. If they get caught. If it comes to fighting, when it comes to fighting, how they fight. Pumpkin had little triangular green eyes in his freckled face. He stared at Johnny. Oh, we'll fight like hell. We always fight like hell. How about you, Mr. Pumpkin?
Me?
The man spat.
I'm not saying much, see? Actions speak loud in words.
You'd leave if you could? Pumpkin screwed up his homely little face.
Miss Scylla, and ain't she the sweetheart, and Mrs. Bessie says you can be trusted. When I can get me a smock such as farmers wear... When I can get me an old hat with black hair sewed in it hanging down like this, see? When I can get a farmer who swear I'm his hired man and take me out past our guard on the neck.
Johnny stepped closer to him. I can get you all that.
You sure?
Sure. You saved me from a flogging.
I sure did.
Oh, I like it here. I want to live here forever. A farm of my own, cows. Poor folk can't get things like that over in England.
You can hear.
Their heads were close together. Pumpkin, glancing nervously about, picked up a heavy hoof and began cleaning it with his jackknife.
Sometime I've got to trust somebody, make a break for it. As might as well be you. And now...
But if you're caught, you'll get shot.
I'll get shot? Hell, what do you expect in the army?
Look here, I can get those clothes. Bring them up here, hide them in the hay in the barn. Scylla will tell you when and where I put them. I can get in touch with a Lexington farmer who comes in every Thursday for market. He'll take you out. I'll tell Scylla, and she'll tell you, and then... And then you'll be free. Never hear another sergeant yelling at me as long as I live. A farm. Cows. That's it. And good land can still be had here for the clearing of it. I'm no soldier, I'm a farmer. I hate the smell of gunpowder. What I like is manure. But just one thing, Mr. Pumpkin. I'll do all that for one thing. I want your musket. For a friend of mine. Can you hide it in whatever place I decide to hide the farmer clothes for you? I could do that. Before Johnny's mother died, she had made him 4 smocks. She made them so large she believed they would last him through his indenture. But he had never worn them. Farmers wore smocks, as did teamsters, porters, butchers, brickmakers. But not silversmiths, nor printers. And never a horseboy. He had not ever put one of them on. He looked down upon smocks. They were not the fashion in his trade. He took one of them from his sea chest in the attic. It was a fine light blue. He had never noticed before how beautiful was the stitching, and it hurt him to think that he had been too proud to wear them, for now he was old enough to appreciate the love that had gone into their making. How little his mother had known of the working world to make smocks for a boy who she knew was to become a silversmith. She hadn't known anything, really, of day labor, the life of apprentices. She had been frail, cast off, sick, and yet she had fought up to the very end for something. That something was himself, and he felt humble and ashamed. A hat and an old black wig were not hard to find. He sewed them together as best he was able. There was a pair of Uncle Lorne's old breeches Aunt Jennifer said he might have, but he confided only in Rab. Rab must see to it that the uncle who every week smuggled out copies of The Observer also took out the British deserter. 10 days later, Scylla told him the farm clothes he had hidden in the hay were gone, and Pumpkin had left behind him his musket and uniform. The musket was smuggled out to Lexington by Rab's uncle. It was lashed to the tongue of the wagon so cleverly it never showed. But the British deserter did not show up in his blue smock and false hair to ride out of town with Rab's uncle. He seemed to have completely disappeared. At first the British were much excited and searched Boston from end to end. When Pumpkin had been gone a week, Johnny stopped worrying about him. Doubtless he had found some other way of getting out of town. Rab did not say much when Johnny showed him the musket he had got for him, but his eyes glowed. Johnny, trained in a silver shop to do such work, made a bullet mold. Together at night, behind locked doors, they cast bullets. From where they squatted by the hearth in their attic, they could hear the carefree laughing, singing, and sometimes drunken quarreling of the officers billeted at the Afric Queen. All over New England, people were casting bullets. There was little lead. Women were taking their beautiful pewter from dresser shelves, stoically watching it melt in crucibles. Porringers, tankards, spoons, teapots were being reformed into bullets. Aunt Jennifer herself gave Rab her pewter. Much of it had been in her family for 100 years. She loved her pewter, but she stood dry-eyed and looking, for her, a little stern as she saw it disappear in Johnny's crucible. Gunpowder was even harder to get, but all over New England, saltpeter, sulfur, and charcoal were being ground to a paste, made into gunpowder. It was going to be needed. Each minute man made his own bullets, and then his cartridges, to fit his own gun. The powder and ball were rolled up in a paper cylinder. Uncle Lorne contributed bound copies of sermons to be torn up for paper, but this paper was too tough. The soldier had to bite off the end of his cartridge before he loaded his gun. Half the powder was poured into the pan. The rest of it and the bullet and the paper were rammed down the barrel. The sermons were so tough that not even Rab's strong teeth could get through them. Luckily, notepaper was more delicate. Scylla collected a basket full of notes that the British officers had written Miss Lavinia. Rab's bullets were wrapped in an assortment of invitations to balls, protests of undying adoration, crude sonnets comparing her to Diana and Aphrodite. Once Johnny recognized Stranger's schoolboy hand. From now on, when the men drilled at Lexington, Rab would have his box full of cartridges and, as he said, "Thank God, a decent weapon in my hands." 4. Then March was over, and it was April. The tension in Boston grew. Everyone knew that with the coming of spring, General Gage would leave the safety of Boston, strike out into the country as commanded by his king, and this time in considerable force. He would never dare send out a mere handful. He knew how well the provincials were arming, preparing to welcome him. King George was in a fury over the dilatory, cautious behavior of his general. Rebellion had not been put down as he had ordered, and every day it was growing stronger. Few military supplies had been seized. Everywhere throughout New England, men were drilling. His Majesty had expressly ordered all such militia companies to disband. Word came to Boston that three generals, more ferocious than mild General Gage, were already on the way over to take command. Generals Howe, Clinton, and Burgoyne. Doubtless, perhaps against his better judgment, Gage would make his big sortie before the Cerberus arrived with the three new generals. Johnny continued to watch every move of Colonel Smith at the Afric Queen. He listened to every word Dove absentmindedly let fall about what he had heard or seen. In spite of a slight fear that he might, once more, meet that half-shaved, shirt-sleeved officer who had ordered him whipped, he went almost every day to the common. Sometimes he exercised Colonel Smith's two horses, riding Sandy and leading Nan. Until he got on Sandy, he had no idea that riding could be so tame a sport. He had rather taken it for granted that whenever you rode a horse, you risked a broken neck. The mildness of all horses after Goblin amazed him. He had learned the hard way, but he had learned. 5. Johnny, riding Sandy and leading Nan, came down Frog Lane, skirting the common. He was more cautious nowadays about crossing through the British encampment. Exercising Colonel Smith's horses was Dove's work, but Johnny always did it for him and let Dove sleep. On the common, he could see that Earl Percy was parading his entire brigade, all three regiments. But Percy was always doing that. He kept after his men, training and drilling them more than any other commander in Boston. He was a first-class officer. Although the heights of the common were filled with men marching, forming columns, and whatnot, Johnny believed he could sneak in by the hurdles and let Sandy and Nan graze along the Charles. He knew this fresh grass was as dear to them as sweets would be to him, if he could get them. The day was so warm he rode in his shirt sleeves. April was more like May that spring. He was filled with lassitude and a sense of peace. As he turned in the path along the lower end of the common, he was thinking of nothing except only how much the horses would enjoy the fresh grass, and how much he would like some sweets himself. He did not notice a small group of redcoats doing something down among the salt marshes. They might be catching eels for all he knew or cared. The horses dropped their heads, spread their legs a little, and tore ravenously at the green shoots of grass. Then he heard a somber rolling of drums, not the usual brisk tattoos. Seemingly, all Percy's brigade were marching down upon him. The only place they did not inundate was the patch of hard earth where the hurdles were, and where he now sat with Sandy and Nan. They were bringing up platoon after platoon. Sandy, the old war horse, hearing the drums, the tramp of feet, immediately lifted his head, arched his neck, cocked his tail, and struck a martial attitude. Nan did not hold much by anything connected with the army. She went on eating. Johnny looked about him. For the first time, he took in what that small band of redcoats, so close to the salt marsh, was about. He saw the chaplain reading from his open prayer book, the wooden coffin, the hastily dug grave. Those eight men and their officer were not out catching eels, as they should have been on so fair and lazy a day. They were a firing squad. That man, tied and blindfolded, was a deserter. Percy had ordered out his entire brigade to watch, hoping it would cure them of any itch to desert. A blue smock, a mop of orange hair. So they had caught Pumpkin. He was not to die in the handsome uniform of the King's own regiment which he had disgraced, but in the farm clothes Johnny had procured for him. The boy gritted his teeth, but he was trapped among the hurdles. He could not get away. Standing at attention, eyes straight ahead, were 1,000 or 2,000 men in front of him, and behind him the firing squad, and the river. The drummers in their high bearskin caps stood with lifted sticks, waiting. The sound of the volley and the roll of the drums came together. What had happened behind his back he saw reflected in the stony eyes, the white and sweating faces before him. One young officer looked positively green. Only Sandy seemed to enjoy the occasion. As he heard the drums and the firing, he lifted his head even higher. Nan squirmed. If Colonel Smith had been on her, he would doubtless have rolled off. Johnny put his hands to his face. It was wet and his hands were shaking. He thought of that blue smock his mother made him, now torn by bullets. Pumpkin had wanted so little out of life. A farm. Cows. True, Rab had got the musket he craved, but Pumpkin wasn't going to get his farm. Nothing more than a few feet by a few feet at the foot of Boston Common. That much Yankee land he'd hold to Judgment Day.
Hurrup! Hip! Hip!
The firing squad was coming up behind him. He did not turn his head. Now they were passing close to him, their backs coming into his range of vision. Grenadiers they were, in bearskin caps, coattails buttoned back to show their white breeches. Squared scarlet shoulders, and on each shoulder a musket. Each musket ended with a wicked round eye, watching him, so it seemed. Eight cruel eyes. It was like looking into the face of death. Johnny had always been bold enough, talking about what came, never fearing a fight, and there was much fighting among the boys along the wharves. He had never once doubted his physical courage, but now he did. He could not see how anyone, certainly not himself, could ever have the courage to stand up and face those murderous little eyes. That night, for one horrible moment, he was glad his hand was crippled. He would never have to face the round eye of death at the end of a musket. For days he felt his own inadequacy. Was the bold Johnny Tremaine really a coward at heart? Had Rab ever felt as he did now? You could not guess by looking at him. If he had any qualms, he would never mention them. Johnny decided to do the same, but Pumpkin's death badly unnerved him. Chapter 10. Disperse, ye rebels. The 14th of April, 1775. General Gage had sent out spies dressed as Yankee men looking for work. The spies came back on this day. All the colonels were at the province house with General Gage listening to their reports. Joseph Warren knew this, so did Paul Revere, even Johnny Tremaine. It was easy enough to find out that spies had returned, were reporting to the commanding officer, but what had they reported? This was not known. The 15th of April. This fell upon a Saturday. At every regimental headquarters, the same general orders were posted, signed by Gage himself. All the grenadier and light infantry companies were to be taken off duty until further orders. They were to be taught some new evolutions. Johnny himself read these orders posted in the lower hall at the Afric Queen. One man was grumbling, "New evolutions. What was Grandma Gage thinking about?" But Lieutenant Stranger, as he read, whistled and laughed. "That," he said, "looks like something, at last." Each regiment had two companies picked and trained for special duty. The light infantry were the most active and cleverest men in each regiment. Lieutenant Stranger was a light infantry officer. These men were lightly armed and did scout and flanking work. In the grenadier companies you found tall, brisk, powerful fellows, hard-fighting men, always ready to attack. If you have 11 regiments and pick off from each its two best companies, it adds up to about 700 men. All day one could feel something was afoot. Johnny read it on Colonel Smith's florid face. He was stepping across the Queen's stable-yard very briskly and remembering to pull in his paunch. There was ardor in his eye. Was it martial ardor? Lieutenant Stranger was so happy over something he gave Dove threepence. Spring had come unreasonably early this year. In the yard of the Afric Queen, peach trees were already in blossom. Stranger was so happy something was bound to happen. Over on the common, Johnny found Earl Percy's regiment unlimbering, polishing two cannons. The soldiers were forming a queue about a grindstone, sharpening their bayonets. What of it? They were always doing things like that. Did all this mean something or nothing? He went to Mr. Revere's, whose wife told him to look for him at Dr. Warren's. The two friends sat in the surgery making their plans and listening to reports that were coming from all directions. Seemingly, the excitement among the officers, the preparation among the soldiers, had been noticed by at least a dozen others. But where were they going? Who would command them? No one knew. Possibly only Gage himself, although before the start was actually made, he would have to tell his officers. All that day the British transports had been readying their landing boats. This might mean men would be taken aboard, move off down the coast, as Salem had been invaded 2 months before, or that they were standing by merely to ferry the men across the Charles River, land them in Charlestown or Cambridge.